Groundwater cleanup programs.
Cleans out that room too.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's fine.
Since the chair isn't here, we will wait a moment. Mr. Chair, we're paging the cleanup staff because we wanted them to have the benefit of this presentation and hear from you and any reaction. So they are being paged, and we'll take a moment to file in.
Just make it about a 5-10 minute
okay,
break.
Okay, 5 break.
I got a lunch day. Get me there.
Okay. Mr. Rivera, very nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning again, and members of the board. We're here to give you an overview of the cleanup programs in Region 1. With me today is Casey Ashley, who is the Senior Engineering Geologist and Supervisor for the Northern Unit. And the Supervisor for the Southern Unit is Christine Wright Shacklett, who is right there. And with us today is also the dozen or so employees of our of your staff that work in the cleanups division, as well as our student assistants. Notably missing today, and rightfully so, is Mr. David Evans, who has retired. So in a circumstance such as today, David would be here, but he is in Ecuador. So and on
research,
to other things.
Tank research, no doubt.
Research.
Doing extensive research on things that have nothing to do with this. But anyway, that's the situation. So we're giving you a summary of the work, the challenges, and the initiatives undertaken by staff to address the instances of discharges of toxics to waters in the region. We broadly use those terms, toxics, contaminated properties, where water is affected or threatened. You may have a discharge which happened 45 years ago and happens to be all tied up in the soil, and it just happens to start moving because of changed condition. Well, that's a discharge. It started back then. It's still going on today. When we talk about toxics, we're talking about the discharges of petroleum hydrocarbons, other organic compounds such as solvents and the types of things that come out of dry cleaners. We're also talking about heavy metals, PCVs, dioxins, those type of compounds. Your staff supervises the investigation and cleanup of these when these chemicals, these compounds are discharged to the environment. And so how do we go about doing that? Well, two very broad and sweeping bullets that I put in the EOSR, in the summary report here. It's the first task is to identify who is responsible for the discharge and compel those responsible parties to accept responsibility for their releases. Sometimes that takes 5 minutes. Sometimes that takes 10 years, not exaggerating. And once you're beyond that, you work with the discharges, their representatives, their consultants, in such a manner so that the strategy and the approach to the investigation and the cleanup meets the objectives of protecting water quality and is manageable for that responsible party. So for the purpose of this program is replete with lots of acronyms and it's rich in terminology, but it also has quite a substantial base in the science of groundwater hydrogeology. By acronyms and such, you realize that in the state of California, the regulation of toxics and when it comes to, say, the category of underground storage tanks, In California, you have about 100 agencies that deal with that specific component storing a toxic. I say about 100 agencies because that includes the regional boards, that includes the what are called the LIAs, the local implementing agencies, that are the permitting agencies. If an installation is going in, if an installation is being repaired, when tanks are being put in the ground, the permitting for all of that happens at the local level. That might be a fire department, that might be OES in a county, a county health department, that kind of thing. It's whichever way it's done in that specific county. In addition to that, then you have the cleanup layer, which is 9 regional boards, some with multiple offices. And then back in the early 90s, when this program was starting, when program specifically for underground storage tanks was starting, we can see the universe here, as I mentioned, that, you know, we have about 40,000 cases. Well, that was envisioned by the state board, so a program was developed to contract with local health departments, and they would act what I call franchises of the state, and they act as cleanup agencies. Those are the LOPs, the local oversight programs. And in your region, we have 2, Sonoma and Humboldt counties. So where do we go from there? We have, so the world of cleanups is divided for purposes of budget and program. That universe is, that solar system is 2 planets. It's planet underground storage tanks and everything else. If you happen to be responsible for underground storage tank containing petroleum and there is an unfortunate release from it, then you, as a responsible party, are eligible under state law for the state cleanup fund. So per event, $1.5 million for eligible costs associated with the investigation and cleanup of that release. You, as a responsible party, you have the right to apply for those. If you happen to own a dry cleaner and you unfortunately discharge PCE from the dry cleaner, you're on your own. It's up to the responsible party to, by whatever means, seek the funds to respond to the state. And that's really important because the approach is quite different. And as State Board Member Doduk told you this morning, there are several initiatives at the state level to address the underground storage tank portion of it. But we'll speak a little bit more about that. The type of things that Casey will be illustrating to you that we do on a day-to-day basis, the program affects so many people at so many levels that staff is engaged in, for example, dealing with local utilities, the cities, counties, jurisdictions. When people are digging their streets and such, they're calling here saying, hey, you know, we're going down the middle of Sebastopol Road. What kinds of things we're going to be in this intersection? We'd like to know. Are we going to bump into anything there? We answer a lot of questions related to that. And foremost in our minds is anyone or any institution dealing with real estate transactions. As such, that is a significant part of our work. The importance of dealing with releases to groundwater in our region has been underscored throughout my tenure, by being in this board. Back in 1993, when the program was mushrooming, meaning the number of underground storage tank cases that were being revealed to us, the board felt compelled to modify our basin plan with an amendment that clearly set the tone for how staff was to prioritize underground storage tank cases. And I copied that for you on page 2 of your executive summary report. And the words there ring quite well, even today, as a solid approach on how to go about dealing with this immense caseload that we have. I really like to underscore the fact that this is all done because of the importance, the emphasis, and the relevance of shallow groundwater as a source of domestic and industrial supply in our region. So I will have some concluding statements after Casey has her presentation, and then I will be open to your questions. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to pass the microphone to Ms. Ashley.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Ashley, and all of your staff. We certainly appreciate you all taking the time to come in here and participate in the discussion, or at least listen in. So it's nice to see you, and we all really recognize that this your division deals with some of the nastiest stuff in our region, and you know, we sincerely appreciate all of the work that you do for that.
Thank you. For those of you that are not familiar with the Cleanups Division programs, I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version of what we do on a daily basis. 20 years ago, when I started to work in cleanups, I was told that 25% of my work time would be out in the field actually watching work being performed. Sadly to say, the reality of our job is that less than 5% of our time does staff actually get out in the field to observe things. Our main duty is to oversee work. I'm not going to do those for a while yet, so. Our main duty is to oversee work proposed by registered professional engineers or geologists and conducted under their direction. Our goal is to ensure compliance with the California Water Code and the applicable laws, rules, and regulations. Staff reviews documents that fall into three main categories: contaminant source identification, work plans for work to be performed out in the field, and then the reports of it was actually conducted in the field, and the remediation plans and reports. The level of complexity of the review of the reports range from this size to several banker's boxes full of binders this size. The complexity of the site will determine determines the size of the documents. And that's based on the contamination type, the size of the facility, and the extent of the contamination. Staff comments on documents and attempts to keep all the sites moving through the investigation process and then implementing cleanup actions where necessary. Along with overseeing the investigation or remediation work, staff must handle all aspects of water board activities. This ranges from drafting cleanup and abatement orders for enforcement, reviewing stormwater reports, reviewing and drafting waste discharge requirements where applicable, and ensuring compliance with general waste discharge requirements also. Also fit in with all the document reviewing are the meetings, conference calls, database maintenance, and responding to inquiries, as Louise said, from the public, prospective purchasers of contaminated property, and other agencies. Now I'm going to direct you to some pictures that will tell our story in an easier way. And just so that you know, for your information, all the pictures are from sites within the North Coast region, and with the exception of this first one, they are all currently the sites are being investigated or are in the process of remediation. And because I've worked with most of these sites, I just need to let you know that if I call the site by a name, it's probably the file name in the GeoTracker database, and it's not necessarily associated with current or historical responsible parties. We receive information on discharges to the environment in various ways. Some are obvious and some are not. Our first job is to determine the responsible party and the source and type of contamination that may be present. Some investigations are the result of current development of properties that had various historical uses. You may start with a photo of past activities, and just as an example on this one, at this particular site, there were underground storage tanks. This was a vehicle maintenance area. This is a green chain where they treated lumber with pentachlorophenol, and this is a teepee burner with dioxins being emitted into the air, all of which were investigated at this site. We also can just get a general idea of a former gas station that were present on property sometimes, and that information is collected from old telephone book records and the Sanborn insurance maps. Some investigations start with accidents that result in easily identifiable discharges that are quickly getting to waters of the state. This type of activity results in an immediate response by a whole team of your staff. staff out in the field to collect samples and warn residents of dangers, staff at the office drafting enforcement orders, and staff reviewing documents for the work to be performed. This is, as you can tell, the red diesel actually got into a creek from that spill. Other investigations are with industrial sites that may have ceased operations or are still in operation. In areas where lots of industrial activities are located, the discharges may be running into each other, and interpreting the data is very complex. Trying to piece together all activities that could have happened at a closed industrial site is very difficult. Staff then tries to determine which contaminants are associated with each current and former site activity, and the determination is very complex and subject to debate from all types of interested parties. For instance, in this area of Eureka, this was a development that was built over several parcels. The parcels included an asphalt batch plant, a former sewage treatment plant, and a fire training area where they actually had lit pits of petroleum products on fire and then practiced discharging them. This building here treated plywood with pentachlorophenol. This, as you can see, is an above-ground tank petroleum storage facility that also had a significant solvent release because in the late 1800s, they used to clean the barrels of petroleum with solvents. This is a currently operating lumber mill that has a pentachlorophenol release associated with it. Some smaller investigations are built on top of larger investigations. This is an example of poor housekeeping at an industrial site that then results in hazardous waste being put somewhere where it wasn't originally used. Another aspect of our job is to try and determine the contamination in the source that just starts appearing on surface water. This particular spill took us several months to determine the source of this. This is actually gasoline on top of a creek. In the meantime, the city of Eureka was getting prepared to close down the Montgomery Ward store the weeks between Thanksgiving and Christmas because the vapors were going into their air system. Luckily, it didn't happen, but it took a lot of work to stop it. The easiest site to identify the source of contamination is the corner gas station. The records are usually readily accessible about the size of the underground storage tank and the contents. Most often, too, someone will see the tanks firsthand when they're removed. Historical gas stations are considerably more complex and trying to determine what may have been stored and where. Please note that the ages of tanks are important. As you can see, these tanks are still riveted together. They're very old. Contamination may be readily smelled and seen at these sites. This is actually contaminated soil, and it's readily obvious when you know what you're looking for. There are many ways to investigate soil and groundwater discharges to soil and groundwater and air. In the last two decades, the list has grown exponentially. Each sampling technique has good points and bad. You can imagine the difficulty of trying to identify something that none of us can see. You will recall the story of the blind men and their description of the elephant. Here are just a few of the numerous ways to investigate the subsurface. The work is being conducted by professional engineers or geologists by either their specific firm or contractors that is hired by them. The first and easiest thing is potholing or trenching a site. This can be readily done. And we'll give you a first glance of what may be under the surface. Also, when you're repairing underground utilities and equipment, you can sometimes identify discharges and also stop them if necessary. A significant amount of our work is done by drilling below the ground surface and either collecting samples directly or installing a permanent sampling location where you can collect samples over time. You will note that there are times when the ground surface is not readily available. After the complete extent of the contamination is defined, the remediation system is designed. The size for a remediation system will range from one that fits in your backyard to ones that are larger than this room. Here's your backyard version. This is actually a treatment system that's treating a private well's contaminated water before they use it. The easiest removal and remediation system is the removal of contaminated source material, Once the excavations are done, they will be filled in with clean material. There are times that the removal of the contaminated material requires very complex replacement activities. One of these complex projects includes the removal of contaminated sediments and the subsequent rebuilding of a surface waterway. One of the less popular aspects of doing the removal is the fact that a significant amount of contamination is left in place under this structure, because this stream actually goes right along this building. The result is that they had to place a liner at the bottom of the surface waterway and then fill it in and rebuild the surface waterway. And this liner is going to stop the contaminated groundwater from reentering the surface water and then discharging to Humboldt Bay. Here's a mid-sized vapor extraction system at a corner gas station. One of the initial steps that we work with frequently due to financial constraints is that responsible parties will go remove a portion of the hazardous material as money allows and then leave the remaining material in place for removal at a later date. The remaining product is then covered with plastic, and as you can see, the plastic deteriorates over time, and staff has a constant conversation with responsible parties to maintain the plastic at these kind of sites. Here's another interim remedial system. These are air sparging points that are installed along Humboldt Bay, and it's to stop the contaminated groundwater plume and the free product that's on this side of the sparging ports from entering the bay that's on this side. One of the most complex and expensive treatment systems is pumping and treating groundwater to clean up the discharge and maintain hydraulic control of the groundwater so that the plume does not get larger in size. This 70-plus acre facility pumps and treats approximately 250,000 gallons of water every day. The water is transported from over 20 extraction wells in these pipes to their treatment system, which is here, and as you can see, the contaminated groundwater is actually pumped through two 40-foot airstripping towers. It undergoes a carbon polishing and then is discharged to either irrigating their property or to the surface water. And I'll note, to back up Louise's, this area where this site is, there are over 300 domestic wells within a mile of this site that are their only supply of groundwater to the residents.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may make some concluding statements here, as Board Member Doduk mentioned this morning, we have given you, well, first of all, we have given you an overview of the types of things we deal with. But at the state level, the lights are on underground storage tanks and the cleanup fund. To that end, the two task forces have been assembled, and you will see some initiatives coming out of that. And the State Board has followed up with a number of resolutions, actually two of them. And I copied one of them so that you could see it, which is Attachment 3 in the package. Now that we're in the package, what it includes, Attachment 1 is a distillation, a summary of the process in dealing with releases. And Attachment 2 is one of those initiatives undertaken last year to hopefully add clarity and improve our program. In this instance, this fact sheet, given that there is at times concern, controversy as to how much information is necessary for staff to consider a case for closure, this is an attempt, and it's now widely distributed, to act as a blueprint for the type of information that staff will be looking for when the time comes to ask for a closure. In addition to that, we plan this year we'll endeavor to have more communication with the State Board. I understand that Casey and Christine are going to meet with their staff on Monday to iron out any rough spots, if there are any, and I'll just go lightly on that, just to, you know, they do their things out there in Sacramento, and we have our ways here too. So we want to make sure that as we go along, that things work out. Also, we would like to meet as necessary or even more often with our local oversight programs. So we will endeavor to do that. Also, in the spirit of this fact sheet and even echoing words back that hark back to 1993, when we talked about how to approach cases, we will propose to have an additional fact sheet that talks about an aggressive approach to cleanups that relies less on let's monitor it and see how much, you know, it goes along and see if we can, you know, divine some information from that. To underscore the aggressive part of it, we're going to go in, we see a release, let's clean it up, let's do a removal, let's do interim actions, and then proceed to monitor. And some of the items that have been brought up at the state level have to do with expenditure of funds. And some of it is actually, some of the criticism is well put. I think that, you know, some of it is we endeavor to comply with the state board resolution, and we're mostly complete. We had to review all our cases and also reduce monitoring from quarterly to what? Two times a year, right? And in many instances, yes, it's appropriate to reduce the amount of money being spent on that. So with that overview, that sort of concludes our presentation, and we would be delighted to hear from you as to reactions or questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to give you the benefit of my fossil status sort of on this board. When I first came on, I couldn't walk down the street in Eureka without concerns being expressed about our toxic program. One, that the staff training levels needed to be upgraded. Two, the delays were incredible. And three, a lack of confidence in making decisions. And one of the great things you've done, I haven't gotten those complaints in a very, very long time. And so I'm not saying, you know, there isn't a lot of work to do, but I do want to say that your work's much more respected on the ground there. And then your approach of cleaning it up and as quick as you can, I think, is much better respected by stakeholders. Even though it adds a little bit of uncertainty, it gets more certainty earlier and many times cleans up the problem. So I just want to compliment you on where the program's come the last 10 years. And also, I forgot, the state used to be down on us for our lax enforcement and achievements, and I haven't, I'm sure they may find a fault. I hate to knock on wood on it, but I haven't heard that complaint either. So I just want to say you're doing some really, a lot of the program's really been done very, very well, and it's improving constantly, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Board Member Corbett, and I accept that on behalf of my staff.
Mr. Massey.
Mr. Norton, thank you. Hales, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rivera, and thank you, staff. This is good stuff. I mean, we are here as an information item, not because there's a problem, and that is really cool. I think I speak for every member of this board when I say keep up the good work. This is important. Groundwater is important to our region. We sometimes tend to overlook it because of the amount of rain that we get, and I'm looking out the window and we're still getting it. But it is groundwater that is really the fundamental, and without you guys, it's there. So rest assured, we will stand behind you. If this is necessary, whatever it takes, bring it to us. But thank you for a really good job.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I can't help myself, so please bear with me. There was one situation 15 years ago in Humboldt County that I don't know whether it reached ever got resolved, but it was oil residue left over from whaling, so whale oil, and there's a lack of statewide guidelines on cleaning that up. Has everyone, are you aware of whether anyone's been able to address that rather unique problem in a couple sites in Humboldt Bay? And I mean, don't take this too seriously. This is not a huge critique.
Sure, but Board Member Corbett.
Our number one priority.
I learned many years ago, about 25 years ago, that someone in Sonoma County had an underground storage tank of dog shampoo. And that one we really don't have. Surfactants, maybe. I don't remember that one, Board Member Corbett. I don't remember the oil situation. But, you know, there's parameters in terms of any discharge that, you know, turns out to be a conundrum as to, well, what's that stuff? It's the same principles apply. How what is it? How do you analyze it? Where is it going to move? And is it harming anything? Or, you know, those kinds of elements always apply. So thank you for that. Thank you for that.
And you won't find those sites on GeoTracker.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Noren.
I've had the pleasure, actually, to be a consultant for the last 15 years and work with many of you folks. I've worked in the underground tank world for a long time, and I know by doing, by sitting on this side of this table, that I walk a fine line as a board member and as a consultant. I think I know most of the time where that line is, and when I don't, I call Sam and our attorneys and try and get clear. A couple suggestions and comments. I echo my board members. I fully support what you do. The importance of our work in protection of groundwater, oftentimes, whether it be a leaking tank or a dry cleaner or a slick site or whale oil, I don't know that one, but it's oftentimes unseen. You don't, you know, it's underground a lot of the time. It's there, though, and you're right, Casey, that some of this stuff, or Luis, that this stuff, I've pulled tanks that are 50 years old, and it's still there. And it doesn't readily go away. You know, the natural attenuation curve is a long curve. With that, too, it's very difficult, in my experience, to clean this stuff up. It's a very much a process of discovery to figure out how deep, how far, and how wide. It's expensive. It takes years to get this done. And it's a sustained effort on staff's part, consultant's part, I would say, from my experience, and a responsible party standpoint. And with that, again, just to recognize that and the importance of our groundwater in Region 1, my concern really is that the state board process is really a process about the fund and the upset of the fund that resulted in a resolution process that we're now in the middle of. Region 1 is specific to shallow groundwater. We have shallow groundwater that is absolutely valuable and that we have to be highly protective of. That said, I support my board members in their indication of we support you of being diligent and strong on protection of groundwater in this region. Oftentimes we have contaminants that are awful. They're highly toxic, carcinogenic. They're miniscule in groundwater, and they go a long ways, and they impact huge areas. And by that, they limit economic and use of properties. They impact the beneficial use of groundwater and sometimes surface water, and they cause a big mess out there. So the importance of this work really cannot be overstated. I'm interested in a couple things, though. The review process that it sounds like is almost complete, what is your findings with that? What were your findings with the state complying with the state board resolution?
I'll turn that over to you, Casey.
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Meaning, are they need to be closed or
We reviewed a significant, well, we reviewed almost, I think we were up to like 97% of the sites had been reviewed for closure. I think we've closed 20 sites since the resolution was passed. We have 7 or 8 more that I know of, I'm real familiar with right now, that are going to be closed in the next couple of months. As you can imagine, though, the resolution said, gee, stop all other work and just do this. The reality of life isn't that our staff works on just one program. They work on both programs, so they stopped some work and kept doing others. if, let's say, we close 40 sites this year, that's only about twice what we generally close in the UST program per year anyway. So it may have gotten you 20 more sites closed this year, but I will also say that the ones that weren't ready for closure aren't going to get there any sooner by us completing forms on the GeoTracker database. All the monitoring reductions have been done. Every site was looked for that. All the letters went out, either reducing monitoring or explaining to everyone why it wasn't reduced, and those letters are all uploaded onto the GeoTracker as required.
If I may, just going back to the numbers, we have 466 open cases. If we were to have 46 cases, it would be 10%. So we are a little less than that. So that puts us in terms of closures for this review period and focusing just on figuring out, okay, what is the low-hanging fruit we can just close? That we weren't working on it because we were working on other higher priority issues, but now the higher priority is closing cases. So we are, I would say that we're about 8% or so, and that puts us in the window with everybody else.
Can you also take a minute? The end game with all these sites is always the magic no further action closure letter that everybody wants, and it's a long road. But can you take a moment and just explain the criteria for closure? That this fact sheet, I have to say, the fact sheet I find to be very good. And my suggestion, I told you this actually recently, that you know, my suggestion is to take this fact sheet and put it front and center with the first 13267 letter, because it really is the guide, whether it be a regional board site or whether it be an LOP site that we concur on closure with, that it really becomes the guide that unless you have really met this criteria, and I'll retract my question that you have to discuss criteria here about it, because I think it is this fact sheet. And my point is that I think that putting this out there for public consumption, consultant consumption, agency consumption is a really good thing. I think it breeds consistency. I think it makes it clear about what we need. And that's different from what we want sometimes, but what we need to evaluate a site for closure. And I think it's a very important fact sheet and guide to through that process, because I am a bit leery of a process to close. You mentioned low-hanging fruit, Luis. The low-hanging fruit is the easy part. There's tons of stuff that's not low-hanging fruit that I'm sure this staff knows well about the tough sites that are out there, because the easy sites are pretty much done to some extent. If they're not closed, they're probably going that way. It's the sites that you have, you know, impacts that are just darn hard to get at, or you have no funding source, or you have recalcitrance, or a variety of things that are impediments to getting to that end game. But I do think that this attachment to this fact sheet is a very, very important document. And one request I would have is that put it out there. Whether you do that now, I don't know, but I think I would put it out there every chance you get to make sure that we have a level and consistent playing field out there to what we need as regulators and what you need as staff to evaluate a site for closure, instead of closing it for the sake of closure or closing it because it's expedient or somebody wants it to be done. No, this is what we need right here. A couple more just comments. The state board process, the resolution process, I talked to Tam this morning just for a minute as a sidebar. My understanding is that the state's going to develop what is going to be termed a low-risk closure criteria. And that will be probably, it sounds to me like, within the next probably year, we will see in some form from the state board, perhaps, a closure criteria of low risk. Risk is a really interesting thing to me because it can be subjective. Risk to a regulator when you talk about anthropogenic, carcinogenic compounds is a bit daunting to risk some of this stuff away in a region where we're highly dependent upon groundwater, where we have very shallow groundwater that's of high beneficial use, and I'm a bit leery of that. But that is my understanding within what's possibly coming. I would ask that our staff here, for one, think about that, about how that process goes, how we participate within that process. I would let you know that, again, I walk that fine line, but I asked him if I can, as a board member, be involved within that, at least to represent what we want, because we as a region are specific and very much geographic and geographically, hydrologically different from other regions where groundwater is at 300 feet. And it just is a whole different thing in Region 1 in that way. A last comment is you mentioned the LOP, Sonoma County and Humboldt County, I believe, are the two only LOPs here. Just so that we get it out in the open, that our LOPs have some sites that are just as nasty as the ones that I'm sure our staff deals with. The importance of the relationship and the synergy that we gain by working effectively with LOPs and their process, because at the end of the day, those LOPs, it's my understanding they're not necessarily required to come to us for a closure concurrence, but yet that is the process. I would really like to see that be the process so that we have a play in how these things are closed and a say in meeting our fact sheet requirements or our regulatory obligations. But the Sonoma County LOP and the Humboldt County LOP are two important players, and the importance of that relationship, I think Casey or somebody mentioned here, maybe Luis mentioned that, you know, that there's action there too to further that relationship, better it, maintain it, and all that stuff. As a close, and I'll just be quiet after that, is just that I really do support this staff and the work that you do. It's often unseen. I in the 2 years I've been on this board, I think two or three times there's been action items. They're uncontested usually, but action items. But you're somewhat an unseen staff to this board, but yet your importance is no different than any other staff here. So keep going. And, you know, if we could be of help to you as a board, please let us know.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much. You bet. Ms. Coleman does not take offense to our audience dispersal
I know.
The onset of her.